Welcome to the sixth episode of Three Cartoon Avatars. I'm your host, Logan Bartlett, and I'm joined today by my esteemed co-hosts, the Don of the G-Wagon, Nikita Beer, and the George Costanza of Venture Capital, Zach Kukoff. How are we doing, guys?
Doing all right.
Only all right?
That's about it, yeah.
Last week was much more dour, so I guess we've everyone hanging out together was put a little pep in Nikita's step. How's the week been since I've seen you guys last? So I think we alluded to this last week, but we did all get dinner. We broke bread on Monday for the first time since we've been doing this. How's the rest of the week been? Zach, you're still in L.A.?
I'm still in L.A. You can't get rid of me. In fact, I'm trying to see Nikita a whole second time. I liked hanging out so much. We all broke bread together.
If you're lucky. I didn't know Zach's drink, though, was gin and tonic. It kind of resonates with his old man persona.
I was going to say, you know who I learned that from? My grandparents turned me on to it at a too young age to be drinking.
It was the hottest drink of the 1950s, so that makes sense.
That's right. Yeah, thank you to Lydia and Ben Kukoff for turning me on to the gin and tonic at the age of like 14 years old.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm sure there's nothing illegal with that. I don't think there's probably some statute of limitations that exist on your grandparents feeding you alcohol at 14.
I will say the G&T is a chronically underrated drink. I actually think, all right, ready for this? Espresso martini, we all know, used to be the hot drink. I think the next hot drink, gin Negroni. That's where I'm putting my foot in the ground.
Isn't a gin Negroni just a Negroni?
Well, isn't there also another kind of Negroni?
I think it's just a Negroni.
I'm almost certain. I gotta look this up now. I'm almost sure there's another kind of Negroni.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure a gin Negroni is a Negroni.
But there's also a vodka Negroni.
Yeah. I think when people say Negronis, they mean gin Negronis. But
all right, fine. Well, then how about this? I think the Negroni is going to be the hot drink this year, regardless of what the base is.
It's pretty hot already.
Yeah.
I'm accurate. It's called seeing the present clearly. Perhaps you've heard of that. Venture capitalists do it all the time, Nikita.
Yes, exactly. When Zach says he means what's the big nursing compound in Florida? That's where it's really starting to pick off.
Oh, Boca Raton?
No.
The city of?
No. There's the big it's the number one
The villages.
The villages.
Yeah, the villages. Yeah.
Well, Nikita, what did you think of hanging out with VCs for a night, two nights? It feels like you're kind of getting indoctrinated into the culture.
You know how every founder just dreams of being a VC after they have an exit or whatever? And for me, I was like, I was potentially thinking about that career path. But after going to a VC conference, I realized how fucking boring it is.
It's a lot of networking. It's a lot of schmoozing for people like calling that work, right? It's professional networking, I think.
It felt like mildly adversarial. Like everyone's trying to like be the better VC, or they like we're all fighting for this, like for our set of deals and LPs.
Well, especially with you, right? Why do you think we started a podcast and like we exist on Twitter just so we're not like the other VCs, you know? Like that's the whole thing. We're trying to stand out here. So yeah, everyone's kind of like everyone's friends, but also everyone's willing to stab each other in the back, like at a moment's notice if it benefits them. So it's a
I think it says more about Logan's approach to VC. Logan's like everyone is friends, and also everyone is willing to stab each other in the back. Not any individual person who's talking. Everyone.
I will knife someone if the situation benefits me and our returns. You should sleep with one eye open, Zach Kukoff.
Yeah, that's clearly, I know it's coming to me. That's good to know.
But what surprised me was like everyone had like everyone had a $500 million fund, and it just showed how much liquidity is in the market right now. These are people that I've never heard of. They have no, pedigree or professional reputation. And it just seems like there's just too much money competing for too few deals right now.
I mean, yeah. One of the things is that's the case right now, right? But I spent a bit of time with a bunch of LPs over the last week, and there's definitely a liquidity crunch that's happening, right? Like you hear a bunch of LPs feel like everyone's back in market raising bigger and bigger funds, right? Zach, I know you can't comment, but General Catalyst raised a fund recently. Insight had a $20 billion fund that they announced. And there's probably four or five more kind of $2, $3, $4 billion funds that I know are being raised right now. And so I think the LPs are kind of like, what the fuck?
Well, it's not hugely surprising, right? Like our fund closure is public. We can talk about the fact that it happened, but ultimately, like, because every fund has to get really big, really fast, or has to stay super disciplined, all of the funds who kind of sort of grew a little bit now are like frantically trying to grow aggressively. Otherwise, you know, which is going to say crazy sound out loud, like to be merely a $500 million or $700 million fund is sort of a no man's land right now.
Well, you say that. I mean, that's what we are. And I think you sort of need to purposefully do that, right? Like you kind of need to pick. It can't be on the path to a step along the way, right?
Right, like, exactly.
We're staying that way purposefully, and we've sort of been that way for a long time, right? And so we're not aspiring to be a $4 or $5 billion fund. I think the folks that have gone from 100 to 300 to 500 to 700 or whatever, I think if your path is just trying to grow and continue to go up, I really do think there's going to be a cleaving off there. Versus, you know, there are groups that have decided to stay. I mean, Benchmark famously, right? And we'll get to talking a little bit more about them, but staying smaller intentionally. So.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, my point is less about the enduring managers, more about the emerging managers,
yeah,
right? If you're on your way to a $5 billion and $500 million to stop, that's the death zone. If you're disciplined and you've always been $500 million, right? That's a very different situation.
Yeah. Well, I think it was funny, Nikita's observation that like, that there were a lot, there's a lot of like 2, 3, 4. This was before we got on the podcast, but a lot of tier 2, 3, 4 VCs. And I feel like every VC thinks that they're, you know, Sequoia's 1A or something. And then everyone thinks that they're 1B or like tier 2 at worst, right? Like every VC is like, yeah, you know, I mean, we're like 1B. Sequoia, sure, we'll give them their credit, but like we're just right that next tick below. And I think there's like 70 funds telling themselves that they're number 1B in the order.
Do you think these funds actually believe that? Like, I don't know if people are actually like from a truth serum, they'd be like, yeah, we're like number 2 to Sequoia, or is that like a marketing thing they're doing?
They were defending their egos at the party I was at, where they were like saying, yeah, we did this deal from 2013 that returned 100x, but they kept referring to that deal 10 years ago that they did.
That's my favorite trope as a board member, is just like try to bring everything back, like the old board member that like had one big win in, you know, whatever, 2009 or something. They like sold DoubleClick, and they're like trying to vector the conversation back to the one big win they had. Zach, to your question, I think everyone thinks that they're on the ascension, right? If they don't think they're firmly 1B, they think that they're like, you know, that their star is on the rise, right? And that they're very close to being that. I don't think anyone's like, yeah, you know, we're tier 3, but this is probably going to be our place for the next bit, right? Because the ground's moving underneath everyone. And so if you think, like, if you don't think you're ascending, then you're definitely falling in a very meaningful way.
I think that's probably right. I also would say, by the way, Nikita, to your point, like the weird structure of venture is such that you can basically be set for life if you're a small fund and you happen to do one great deal, right? If you're like a $300 million fund and you're the early investor in a $10 billion outcome and you own 20% of it, right? That is like a life-changing outcome for 3 to 4 partners. Because you only need to do one of those to really be successful, you end up with all these folks who have only done one of those and think forever they're like the greatest investor in the world because they had one phenomenal outcome.
Well, and I think at the end of the day, like being rich is different than like feeling important, right? And so there's a lot of people at these conferences that are worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars or whatever it is, right? But no one gives a shit because it happened, you know, 8 years ago, or, you know, they've never had a big win, but they've just been at a big fund and hung around for a while. And so they're like walking around and puffing their chest out, and they grew up under the world in which the VCs had all the power, right? And they're used to Nikita groveling to them to get the fundraised. And now the dynamic has totally shifted. And so I think all these people just feel they're like, 5 years ago, I was so important. And now like no one gives a shit that I invested in, you know, whatever exact target 10 years ago or whatever it is.
Yeah. 5 years ago, all I had to do was do like the most obvious deals in the world, and that made me unfathomably wealthy. And today I can't do that, and people are no longer calling me a genius. Is it me, or is it the macro? Am I good, or was the macro environment really good?
Yeah.
Impossible to answer.
Yeah, it turns out like if multiples appreciate by 5x, like, and you get your pick of SaaS companies, it might not be like you that's actually the generational investor.
That's right.
It might be a little indexed to the circumstances of the time.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, I saved this story. We were at dinner on Monday night, and I wanted to hold off on this because it was a cool experience. And so I told these guys I wasn't going to tell the story for them twice, and that I would actually do it on the pod. But before we hung on Monday night, I actually got to go to SNL for the first time. And this is something I've been sitting on. Like, I had this friend who had a friend, and he said, if ever I wanted to go to SNL, like, let me know. And I was like, ever? And he goes, yeah, ever, if you want to. And so I've been sitting on this for like a year, and I saw a month ago, it came out, John Mulaney was hosting. And Zach, I know you're a big John Mulaney fan as well. Nikita, I don't know your take on it, but what, were you shaking your head?
I would not call myself. I've seen Mulaney in person once, and actually think it's courtesy of Logan, so thank you for that. But that was like the only time ever. And I don't like Mulaney's choir boy shtick. The only time I enjoyed Mulaney was post rehab.
Oh, interesting. It must be the Catholicism. Like, there's enough Jewish comedians for you to focus on that. The Catholic comedians, yeah, that's sort of.
Well, the Jewish comedians don't do the choir boy act. I think it's a whole other. That's like a whole other neurosis that I don't subscribe to.
It is a real irony that like his whole shtick was Catholic, you know, Georgetown dude, and like he had to, you know, go to rehab for 3 months for cocaine use, right? That is like kind of an irony. But yeah, no, it's worth people going back and watching his SNL open. But I went to the dress rehearsal, and yeah, he did a whole bunch of thing about, like, you know, his friends calling in into his intervention, right, and going to rehab for a while and having to delete all his drug dealers' phones and all that. Pretty funny bit. But so I'm sitting there, and you know, this is it felt like a once in a lifetime experience. And so I'm excited to see John Mulaney. LCD Sound System's also playing, who I like. And I have two seats open for me right before it starts. And Chris Rock walks in with his daughter and sits down right next to me. And so now I'm like, you know, center stage SNL, Chris Rock sitting next to me trying to play it cool. And so it ended up being a super cool show. I think the rules were a little different of what I got versus what Chris Rock had to do. Me, they were like, you show up at 7:46, you're out, right? Chris Rock rolled in whatever an hour later. For me, it was like no cell phone. Chris Rock was like texting away the entire show, but it was cool. They had Paul Rudd, Steve Martin, Conan O'Brien, Tina Fey, Candice Bergen, because it was like the five timer thing. So the whole thing was like a super interesting, cool, sort of only in New York experience. So while I love being in LA in the warm weather this past week, there are some benefits to staying in New York.
Did you love being in LA when you took the first flight you could as the second the conference programming was over to get back?
You know,
Nikki and I are going to have a whole fun weekend together. Logan was like, I will be on the first red eye back to New York. Thank you very much.
I did walk into a party, survey the scene, walk out and catch a red eye. So I enjoyed my time.
Enjoyed it, Jason.
Yeah.
I would say that this week was more representative probably of San Francisco than LA because it was a VC conference.
I think that's right.
Yeah,
it's interesting that, like, you know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but it's clear these destination events that like everyone just flies in for like boondoggle networking everyone at once, right? I think that's going to be a rotating thing that, you know, it was Art Basel once upon a time, and now it was Upfront this month, and I'm sure there's going to be another, you know, Miami Tech Week's coming up, right? And so I'm sure that's going to be the same thing, that, you know, everyone just drops into a city, takes over. It's the worst ETH Denver. It's the worst week for everyone on Tinder and Bubble in those cities that all these bros come in and start swiping away.
I know. I can't imagine to be a USC sorority girl this week in LA must have been a hellish experience.
Yeah. There was a lot of swiping to get to the, well, good. So I think first topic we wanted to cover this week was the first episode of Super Pumped, the battle for Uber. So for people that don't know, this is a Showtime show based on the 2019 book by Mike Isaac by the same name. The show was created by Brian Koppelman, who is the creator of Billions and Rounders. And I looked through his Wikipedia, seemingly didn't do anything else between the years like 1998 to 2016. It seems like he took those years off and just did Rounders and then Billions. But
how is that different from VCs?
Yeah, exactly. He's basically a VC.
He did two good deals and then didn't work for 10 years. Yeah.
So the show focuses on the rise and the fall of former Uber CEO Travis Kalanick, who's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Uma Thurman plays Arianna Huffington. She hasn't made an appearance yet. It's narrated by Quentin Tarantino. The series has actually already been renewed for another season, in which they're going to go into Facebook. So it sounds like they're going to keep doing these little like mini series type things focused on some plot in the tech ecosystem. So I guess just as a backdrop before we dive in, I did just a quick flag disclosure, blah, blah, blah. My partner, Elliot, who recruited me into Redpoint, his sister's Austin Geit, who is a character on the show. She's featured prominently in episode one. And so I'm not totally unconflicted in my, you know, my perspectives on this. But yeah, I'd be interested. Nikita, what'd you think?
I thought it was extremely cringy to watch. I think they were trying to go for the same vibe as The Social Network, but it just came off so awkward. But at the same time, I was really trying to separate whether it was actually the show or that tech culture in 2010 was that cringy. In 2010, it was like the post-Facebook like frat era of tech. People were wearing collared shirts and, drinking. They had a beer keg in the office. I think it's most of us like don't really remember that because it was just, we kind of repress it actually. That's how an office was run back then. It's still interesting to watch seeing Hollywood's portrayal of all this. The story definitely needed to be told.
I couldn't stand it. I mean, I felt it was like not, I don't think it was endemic to the time. I think the show was just not a good show. Did you guys read the book? I didn't read the book.
No.
I can't speak to the book, but I thought the show was like cringy to your point, Nikita. All of my ex-Uber friends said, by the way, didn't even feel accurate. Like the actual story is so much juicier, at least from the first episode that we were shown. Like the actual story is so much more interesting than what they ended up focusing on. Like, here's a good example of this, right? They talked about the Safe Rides fee and they called it a Michael Eisner moment. Have any of you ever heard anyone in tech say something as a Michael Eisner moment? Like at any year, to 2010 or today?
No. Yeah. Michael Eisner.
No, of course not.
I don't think people have been taking inspiration from Michael Eisner, right?
It was just so off the mark in both the big ways and the small ways. There was the Twitter thread going around from an ex-Uber employee who said that Joseph Gordon-Levitt had pinged him to hear about what it was like to work for TK. And apparently he like made a point of not talking to Travis himself when he did the actual prep for the show. So the whole thing to me struck me as like kind of willfully a little bit telling a story perhaps that was not necessarily a one-to-one mirror of reality.
What I thought was kind of like missing, and they always do this for any of these like tech stories, is they don't actually tell the origin story. And I think that was probably the more interesting part of Uber, of like Travis didn't really take the company that seriously at the beginning because Ryan Graves was running it. It was more of like a side project. And I think how it eventually became like a core part of his life and it just became his magnum opus, I think that would have been more interesting to tell. But they just kind of glazed over that and acted like he had conviction on day one that this company would be the big one.
Garrett Camp did take an L in the first like 2 minutes of that was just like a brutal opening for him. Just like, and then I shoved you to the side, dork. It was like basically they put him into a proverbial locker and like shut the door.
My new drinking game is every time they have him say, "Are you sure, TK?" in like the world's kind of dopiest voice, just take a shot and you'll be completely blacked out within 5 minutes.
Zach, I'm impressed you went with TK as well. It's like you're basically on the show at this point. Now, you know, I actually enjoyed it. Maybe to some extent I'd lived like this period in time, and so I found it interesting. But, you know, I think it had the thing that they struggled with, which I don't know exactly how The Social Network pushed through and didn't have this problem in my mind, but they're both trying to stay true to the fact that these are real people, right? And capture some of their essence, but also make them compelling characters. And so I thought it was interesting, like the Travis as a character was far less interesting in my mind than Travis as the actual person, right? Normally these things, you sensationalize the character on television and it's actually far more boring than what you get in real life. And here it was actually the opposite. Joseph Gordon-Levitt felt like he was trying way too hard. Like Kalanick had this kind of intimidating energy, but also this charisma, and like the whole bro-y thing for Travis, it was kind of a shtick. At the end of the day, he was kind of a nerd that cared about like the engineering culture, and he put on this like bravado over it all. And I just think he was a much more interesting, like complicated person. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like the guy that was in 500 Days of Summer, like just couldn't really convey that. And so I sort of struggled like just watching him. I actually think someone had this observation on Twitter, but Kyle Chandler, the guy, Coach Taylor from Friday Night Lights, who played Gurley here, I think would have actually been a better Travis Kalanick. Like I think he could have captured that essence of like intimidation, but charisma, but, you know, like could be a little dorky, but also like a leader, right? And Joseph Gordon-Levitt just doesn't really have that for me.
Yeah, I think you're right. There was a total miscast. Again, like it's not shocking when he didn't take the effort to actually go out and talk to the character he's playing, who's very much alive, right? And presumably would have spoken to him. Like to me, that's just it's emblematic of like the whole approach to the show, which is it's not at least The Social Network, for all of its flaws, was a good movie. Like it's a really good movie, as a matter of fact. I was robbed for Best Picture. Like that was a fun, great narrative, true or not, probably not. At least it works as art. This to me is, it fails on two levels. It doesn't feel like it's true. And also I don't think it works as a piece of art either.
What do you think the difference is that Social Network did? Like, do you think they just casted it better? Cause this certainly has elements of the plot. Now they went into more of the origin story and all of that. But what do you think like this is missing that Social Network got right?
Social Network was directed by David Fincher. I mean, one of the greatest directors of all time. Cinematography was beautiful. The score was amazing. Like the way that
written by Aaron Sorkin, right? My absolute favorite screenwriter because I'm trash, but yeah, by Aaron Sorkin, who's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, the dialogue was great. The characters all had very strong identities that were like most of them were pretty likable. And I think seeing it start from the dorm room level made it feel like this, you know, rags to riches story. Everyone was flawed, and they were flawed in a way that you could understand where they came from. I think it was really robbed of Best Picture, and it was just an amazing film. It felt like they were trying to chase after that vibe with this show, and they just totally missed the mark.
I almost would rather have seen them not take it seriously. Like, I felt like The Social Network, because it was so well written and it was so well directed, Nikita, to your point, the score was so great and it was so well acted, Logan, to your point, right? Like, it works as a serious, self-serious piece. Although there are still some lines, sorry, my prod is at the cleaners. There's still some lines that are sort of ridiculous on their own merit. But like this one, it because the dialogue was off and all the small things they got wrong and the things didn't ring true, I almost would rather have seen them like go really campy and kind of play it up really big and be kind of winking and knowing they're ridiculous, rather than try to like straddle this line of not being hyper accurate, or at least not feeling accurate in an impressionistic sense, but also not being funny enough to be a fun hate watch either.
Do you think we're like too close to the circumstances around this, both from a time period as well as like our careers and understanding that like the little offness of the power dynamic with VCs and, you know, all that stuff is actually bothering us more? Like it's kind of weird for me to internalize seeing Gurley, who, you know, I know of a little bit, and seeing him as like this, you know, handsome, smooth talking Kyle Chandler character with his two dorky associates like Kohler and Fenton. Like that was actually high comedy, that Gurley is actually friends with Koppelman, which is funny, but Gurley gets played by this like handsome smooth character, and then Kohler and Fenton take these dorky L's with the characters that they got. But I don't know how much is like it's bothering me that I have more of an appreciation of the essence of these characters than The Social Network, right? Obviously, I see Zuck, but I don't have an opinion about Zuckerberg, like, in the nuances in the early days, or I see the Winklevoss brothers, but, like, I don't really have an opinion stylistically about how they operate, versus, like, Kyle Chandler throwing on all these, like, hokey Texas mannerisms about, and, like, oh, I'm going to finish your sentence, and, you know, all of that stuff. It just, I don't know, it kind of made me uncomfortable with how dorky it was.
I think Hollywood just wants to portray tech in a certain way, that they know what their audience wants to hear. They want to see the CEO as the adversary, the VC as this Texan oil man who like doesn't look at numbers and just makes shoots from the hip. So I think he's been portrayed pretty unfairly over the years. I mean, he's had inexcusable workplace problems, but to be fair, like Uber has probably saved like thousands of lives from drunk driving. And I think when these Hollywood writers and reporters cover it, they I don't think we should like overlook the mistakes, but I think the fact like preserving human life as a company is a big deal, and it deserves like more recognition than what pundits typically give him.
I mentioned the convenience on the worker side, the convenience on like our ability to get around, like, you know, drunk driving, certainly part of it. And I think they made a mistake of part of what they did super well, Uber in the early days, was just kind of power ahead and take over cities and have their users as evangelists behind what they were doing. Right. And I think they missed the mark on not also doing that from a PR standpoint. They used it from a like government pushback standpoint, but the number of stories that they could have told about, you know, not driving drunk or whatever, and the number of studies that they could have done. Lyft ultimately did some of these studies of like lives saved from drunk driving and all that, but like it was so patently obvious to me the benefit of Uber. And Travis really let that narrative get away from them, which I think was a mistake. And there's kind of this hostility of the media that I think really started in that period of time, right, in the tech ecosystem. And I think if he had been a little bit more proactive and collaborative about this, like they could have owned that narrative in a better way.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, I think it goes without saying, by the way, we didn't even talk about some of the biggest stuff, saving human lives, incredible, but also the fact that taxis just routinely wouldn't pick up people of color, and that's a totally normalized thing for years and years, right? The idea that mostly taxi drivers were in hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt to the medallions. Yeah, the taxi commission here is not the good guys in all of these shows. But I think Uber, if I recall correctly, I'm pretty sure they did have partnerships with Mothers Against Drunk Drivers and all the sort of usual suspects you'd suspect. I think Travis culturally, right, like TK culturally was not the New York Times cocktail party stylistic character. And that's, by the way, most people in tech, right? Most great founders are not the like New York Times cocktail party attendee. And that's fine. But, the challenge is then you get the sort of assorted PR problems that not fitting into that crowd socially creates for you.
I think it's the pattern of like, it's not what you do, it's how you say it. And
yes,
because of his sort of, you know, personality and identity, it didn't matter how many lives he saved. It was more just he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
And you know, the taxi cab locally was much more in bed with media and all of that stuff, right?
Of course.
And so the narratives that were being spun were going to be much more rooted in the local companies and all of that, rather than the social good that was actually happening. But yeah, it's interesting to see all this stuff portrayed. It's disappointing that we don't have more of like a three-dimensional character. I wonder if there's like constraints given to the time, but it felt like they kind of took shortcuts on the character development with regard to, I mean, all of the characters we saw on screen. It felt like they just kind of force fed us that this person's bad. This person's, you know, how many references did they make to like, we don't at Benchmark Capital, we don't shoot our founders. We leave that to Sequoia, which one?
Oh my God. Benchmark Capital, by the way, was the funniest part of that.
Like, that sounds so awkward, right?
Yeah.
Clearly no one like listened to any of this. I was talking to a friend at Benchmark and he's like, I've never heard it called Benchmark Capital. Right. And so it's just like, come on, these little things that, and so I think they just tried to set up a little too much of like the foreshadowing that, oh, Bill is in his camp and now they're using like filling each other's sentences or whatever. And like setting up for the you know, thing at the end, when everyone knows the story, you don't need to bang us over the head with what's going to happen.
By the way, I will say, as much as we're all close to this and certainly not unbiased observers here, like the Rotten Tomatoes score is like 50%, right? So this is not necessarily being widely recognized as some beloved piece of cinema outside of the tech scene.
Well, I guess referenced in the show, there was a line about Travis Kalanick that Travis Kalanick conveyed to his brother about Randy Zuckerberg getting rich from Mark Zuckerberg. Now, I actually didn't know Randy Zuckerberg was a person until that line happened. And then it just so happened she popped up in my life twice this week. So for people that don't know, Randy Zuckerberg is Mark's older sister. It seems like she's become something of an evangelist for Web 3, and she's making these short form videos to raise awareness for crypto and NFT and blockchain or the things like that, I guess. Earlier this week, she posted a video that was set to Twisted Sister's We're Not Gonna Take It. And it was called We're All Gonna Make It. So Justin, I don't know if you can cue this up for us so we can give at least a little bit of a snippet for people to hear. So we'll link the full thing in the show notes for other people to watch the entirety. I think I've watched it 8 times now or so. But Zach, what any thoughts on Randy Zuckerberg's presentation of Web3 here?
I couldn't believe she made a video about the future and the entire thing looked like it came out of 1985. Like that was a little bit surprising to see. I don't know. I just feel like it was a strange. I just felt like it was a strange video to put out. Like, didn't you guys remember the first round Capitol holiday videos they used to do?
Yeah.
So I was in one of those a long time ago, and that felt like the good version of this, right? Knowing sort of tongue in cheek and on the joke. Listen, I have nothing against anybody involved in the video, but it did have like big theater kid energy to me in a way that was like sort of incongruous to everyone I know in crypto, none of whom have theater kid energy.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it just marked the top for crypto. I think that I'm selling everything today.
I actually heard a story, speaking of top of crypto, of like a secondary round going down at multiple billions with all of the money being taken out. And it's called a seed round. And so that was like, I think it was a couple days before this video was posted. So I think it's fair to not mark the top of crypto with Randy Zuckerberg. I mean, Mark like literally created a platform that people conspired to overthrow the government. And somehow I felt like this was actually worse in some ways. Like Zach, you said I don't have any problem with people that made the video. I don't know. I don't know if I could agree there. I mean, I did get whatever 3 minutes times 8 times watching, 24 minutes of enjoyment out of it. So I can't say I'm totally against it, but it was the production quality was actually quite well done. And Lord knows what this actually cost to make. But I don't know if I would chill for this one.
I will say I've gotten more enjoyment out of watching the video lately than I have out of using Facebook. So in the Zuckerberg power ranking, Randy has outstripped Mark in my world.
My favorite comment on that video, though, was it was like a guy that was based in Ukraine said, "I'm in a bunker and this made my day worse."
Oh, man.
It got like 3,000 likes, like ratioed the video.
That is good stuff right there. So I made a list of all the Zuckerberg family videos here, and I would love to get your guys' best and worst from an enjoyment standpoint, what you like the most. So there was the Randy Zuckerberg, "We're All Gonna Make It" video. There was the Mark Zuckerberg, "Smoking Ribs," the Meta announcement video. There was a wakeboarding video where he was flying with the American flag on the 4th of July. And then there was the super sweaty All Things D conference where he basically, you know, looked like he was going to collapse on stage because he was pouring sweat so much. Zach, favorite video and least favorite video of the Zuckerberg family here?
I mean, this is a real tough one. I think this is the hardest power ranking we've ever done in all 6 episodes of the pod so far. But it's close, but I think the number one has to be Mark Zuckerberg smoking ribs. I mean, that is like an iconic all-time video that I will spend my whole life. I will never make content as good as that, no matter how hard I try. I gotta say, least favorite video, probably the 2010 All Things D, because I could very much imagine myself being uncomfortably sweaty at a conference. That feels a little too empathetic to me.
You seem like a sweaty guy.
I don't know that I'm a sweaty guy, but I feel like in that scenario, I could be a sweaty guy.
You give off sweaty guy energy. No, I agree. I agree.
Wow. Nikita. Wow. A little harsh on the pod this week.
Nikita, you're as a former Facebook employee, this was your grandmaster once upon a time here. What was your number one video and what was your least favorite from the Zuckerberg clan?
I mean, he's fully embraced the smoking ribs video of Sweet Baby Ray's. I mean, he has it in the background of all his all hands videos every week. But I have to say that the wakeboarding video, dropping that on the 4th of July, was a power move. And when it actually was released, it was like, it actually resonated with a lot of people.
It was Mark trying to interview at Founders Fund, which was actually, that was a big hit. Mark was really embracing the American flag and flying. It was actually in Tahoe. I had a buddy that sent me a video before Mark had posted it. And he sent me a video and he goes, I think this is Mark Zuckerberg trying to wakeboard with an American flag. And I was like, that seems very weirdly specific, but I agree. That was also my favorite video. The smoking ribs one, I'm going to rank it last on my list, if only because now he's in on the joke, right? Like, I want the ones that he's not quite in on the joke all the way, and he's embraced that one a little too much for my liking. So originally I was very high on it, but it's fallen off since then.
See, I believe in death of the author. I'm not concerned with what Zuckerberg thinks is the best of these jokes. To me, like, the moment of seeing him smoking those ribs forever is so powerful that he can put as many Sweet Baby Ray's sauce packets as he wants on his bookshelf. I'm still going to be a big fan of that video forever.
Hey, by the way, one thing, the most awkward part of the podcast here is our request to like and subscribe and tell your friends if you're enjoying it. So here's me shilling once again for our own podcast.
Shameless.
So one other topic I actually found really interesting this week was DBT Labs, which is a data orchestration company. It's kind of indexed to the rise in data manipulation, indexed to Snowflake and Databricks and all these Amazon Redshift and Google BigQuery and all of that. They were set to raise a big round at $6.2 billion was the valuation they originally targeted. And they actually proactively lowered the round to $4.2 billion. And not only that, but they actually came out and admitted that and said as much, right? And I knew there were a bunch of reporters sniffing around that knew that they originally had it at six and lowered at four. And so I actually thought it was fascinating. DBT, kind of in a masterclass of like PR management, actually owned the story from the start and said, like, yes, here's why we cut it. And so what Tristan Handy, the CEO, said was the investors were ready. It's that we have another set of stakeholders that we care about, the employees. He said the last thing that we want is for our employees or the 300 people that we're set to hire over the coming year to feel like we're not giving them the full opportunity to participate in the upside. So I thought that was actually super interesting. Both DBT handled the PR really well instead of, you know, the information or someone running a story that, hey, this valuation got slashed. They actually owned it and said, hey, this is what happened. And then they actually took the narrative of it and said, and here's why we did it for our employees, right? And so I think that's an interesting kind of PR move that we're seeing more and more. And it sounds self-serving when I say this as a VC, that's like, hey, lower valuation can sometimes be better in recruiting companies, but you are getting more sophisticated engineers and more sophisticated executives that are asking about the 409A price, which is going to be anchored off of these private round valuations, right? And so I think this was actually really smart, not in a VC-centric way, but for Tristan to proactively recognize that the public markets are down 50% and that even though he could have gone higher in valuation, setting the bar a little bit lower is going to be enticing to employees.
Yeah, I think a lot of the best CEOs are increasingly realizing that overly aggressive valuations, particularly when there's not a lot of traction to go on, and that, like, so many of these open source projects, and this is not about DBT specifically, but so many of these open source projects are raising so far ahead of their monetization skis that I actually think a lot of the great CEOs in them are realizing it's to no one's benefit to do that, right? Maybe actually only to a VC's benefit to pump up these valuations aggressively, because it means you can win the deal more easily and you can deploy more capital into these companies. But if you are if you're the CEO of a company and choosing between $1 billion or $2 billion valuation on maybe $1 million in revenue of an open source project, I think you're making your life a lot harder. I think a lot of them are realizing they're making their lives a lot harder to raise that higher valuation.
But I mean, for at least his justification, he's saying he can give out, you know, equity awards that won't go down when it IPOs. I mean, it still would probably be better to give these grants to executive hires that have high headline numbers. Like instead of giving 10 million over 4 years, they offer 15. So I don't see how it actually helps with recruiting. I mean, certainly they might quit if it drops a lot, but they'll still be essentially in the money compared to other offers.
Well, two things. One, the strike price on the options, right, is the first. And so that gets set lower. But then two, I do think there's a sophistication that exists with executives. In particular, you've made this point in the past, that are coming from the public markets and they're saying like, hey, that number is made up, right? And just because one VC said that at a moment in time said that that is what this is worth. And maybe that was below market. Maybe it was market. Maybe it was above where the rest of the market would have come in. They're saying, hey, you know, I can't figure out what this is worth. And so I just can internalize how big of a number the billions are in the business. And I can figure out how much revenue the company has. And I can do that math of, hey, this is 100X or 200X or 500X. And my company in the public markets is trading at, you know, it used to be at 30, 40, 50 times revenue. And now it's down to, you know, 15, 20. And so I think it's more that element of it. And so you're right. You could just say, hey, I'm giving a $15 million package instead of 10. But I do think there's some other, you know, sophistication that play in the more polished executives or engineers.
Yeah, I think you're right, Nikita. If you're you know, hiring the director who's now first time VP, you're probably right. The headline number is the thing people are optimizing for in that case.
Yeah. But the 409 valuation really fucks up a lot of things for all these companies, because I mean, if there is a down round, or if they're struggling to raise capital, a lot of these employees aren't going to fork over money to pay for those options.
Yeah, totally. And then that leads to like perverse incentives, and then, you know, whatever, like the employees aren't actually bought into everything. And so, yeah, it's an interesting conundrum to get in. So I imagine we'll see more and more of this. I actually think it's smart to potentially advertise where interest was from a valuation standpoint. I'll tell you, VCs aren't inherently the ones that are capping price of what people can go to from a valuation standpoint. It's more and more founders saying, hey, this feels like a fair place where there's still a ton of upside that exists for our employees. We still want our investors to, you know, if we execute, do well, right? And I think that's it's a healthier dynamic than what it's been in the past 6 months ago, maybe, where people were just trying to raise at the highest absolute valuation that they could. Okay, another topic of the week was BitConnect founder Satish Kobadhi was just indicted by a U.S. grand jury on charges that he orchestrated a global Ponzi scheme that raised $2.4 billion from investors in a fraudulent cryptocurrency investment platform, the Justice Department said. He was charged in San Diego with misleading investors about BitConnect's purported proprietary technology, which falsely promised returns based on phony volatility software that tracked cryptocurrency exchange markets. Nikita, your thoughts on this?
I feel like the SEC is just taking a dart and just throwing it at the entire crypto industry, and just wherever it lands, they're auditing and investigating that company. Because right now, effectively everything happening in crypto is illegal, because when you're issuing this either NFTs or stocks or whatever, these buyers are expecting a return, and it constitutes a security. And legally, every buyer must be an accredited investor. So virtually all, like everything happening in crypto is illegal securities. And it's funny how the SEC framed this as a Ponzi scheme. My impression was everything in crypto is a Ponzi scheme. I mean, I've talked to quite a few lawyers in this space over the last few weeks, and it seems like the perception right now is that there's going to be a big crackdown on all these companies. Maybe what Satish was doing was maybe more egregious, but I think it's just a matter of time before the government catches up or changes the laws on needing to be an accredited investor to invest in these non-public securities.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like the line between what constitutes fraud and what constitutes a business is increasingly narrow in the world of crypto and NFTs these days.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, I don't see how the SEC goes after all these types of cases, because it just seems like we have, you know, millions of people working on these sorts of this technology, and the public wants it. Certainly, a lot of people are losing money through scams, but I don't know how this is going to play out.
Nikita, pro fraud, pro wash trades here. He's saying they can't catch you, everyone. Just keep running and you'll get away.
Where do you think all the G wagons are coming from? Follow it all the way back, people.
Yeah. Pump and dump, wash trade beer.
I know eventually I'm going to go down. Actually,
it's a matter of time. Yeah. They about the G wagon trade you made with 100K or whatever bump you got after purchasing. So they're looking.
Well, once they saw that the seats hug you as you turn, this is a new feature that Nikita showed me in the G wagon this week. When you make a turn on them, the seats hug you. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And what I usually tell if a girl's riding in the car is it's like having a boyfriend.
Nikita Beer, so alone he has his car hug him. Yeah, that's
Logan's a little sharp this week. Had some zingers.
Lack of sleep flying back on that red eye. Yeah. You guys are all collateral damage for me at this point. So another thing this week that I found interesting was Homebrew, which is Hunter Walk and Satya Patel's fund, a 9-year-old San Francisco-based seed firm, has announced that they're making their last new investments out of their third fund, and that the fund going forward will operate as a as an evergreen entity, backed only by Hunter Walk and Satya's money. So, Zach, do you have any thoughts specifically about this structure? I think some of us know the Homebrew guys, and so I actually don't have any inside baseball on the decisioning. This is all sort of outside in speculation, but would love to hear your thoughts as well.
Yeah, I have nothing on Homebrew specifically, and by the way, I'm a big fan of Hunter and Satya's both. So it makes a lot of sense for them.
Yeah, keep the deal flow coming, guys. That's what I.
Yeah, please. Yeah, well, Hunter and Satya, we're big fans. What I will say is, like, I think it does make sense. I mean, just look at the market for a second. There's a swath of GPs who have done phenomenally well in the last 10 years, right? And some portion of those are going to retire and say, hey, you know, no more. And we've saw that happen this summer, a bunch of those folks, right? And some swath, I actually think an increasing swath, are going to do what Hunter and Safi have done, right? And say, hey, we've done well. This entire, you know, macro tech market's done quite well for us. Why wouldn't we now go and transition to only managing our own money and avoid the stress and the hassle of all the things that are involved when you take money from others, right? I actually think it makes a lot of sense. And by the way, you see it all the time in every other financial vertical. Why not in venture?
Yeah, that's what I think is actually, I mean, the, you know, 0.72 when Steve Cohen was actually kicked out of trading other people's money for a long time.
A different outcome, certainly.
But in the hedge fund industry, like, the people have made so much money and have moved more and more to being family office structures, right? And whether or not it was illegal or not, the reasons that they were forced into doing that. So I think it is interesting. I mean, it's a lot easier to make. You can write smaller checks, and you're not dividing the money you get back by. It's not 20% or 25% or 30% or whatever in the carried income that you get back. Like, all of it's yours. And so you can be a fifth the size, a fourth the size, a third the size, and actually be able to generate more money for yourself. And I think it actually aligns interests with founders as well. If you're going to stay small, right? Like, it aligns interests for Satya and Hunter to be able to stay small and still generate returns. And also, it aligns interest from the founders that they're able to still get their involvement without needing to be force-fed huge chunks of capital.
I mean, as an investor, I probably want to follow on all their deals, because now it's their own money at stake.
100%. We all have to put our own money at stake. But yes, 100% of their own money, to be clear.
I mean, everyone I know has their own rolling fund, and they constantly send me deals. And I'm like, how much of this is your own money? Like, because I don't have my own fund. I'm just putting in my own checks. And they're like, well, all my deals are marked up 5x. I'm like, what does that even mean?
Well, syndicates and rolling funds are like the least amount of your own money, right? Like, that's like the least levered relative, or sorry, the most levered, sorry, relative to like the Logans of the world who have to put I don't know what Logan's GP commit is, but sizable.
My debt is bigger than my my assets versus liability math is not great. I do think it's an interesting point. Do you structurally, do you know with these rolling funds, do you have to put up 1%? I assume legally you have to put up, that's the legal bare minimum that you have to put up.
I think so, but I think that percentage drops very quickly once the checks start rolling in.
Yeah.
The strangest thing about them is, so I'm in a couple and you put in your bank information on the AngelList page. And they just pull money from your account like on a quarterly basis without even telling you. And I eventually logged in. I'm like, whoa, what's going on? I had to like turn them all off because they were like just depleting my entire bank account.
What's easier to cancel, the New York Times subscription or a Rolling Fund subscription? Two very insidious things.
Yeah. I mean, you have to like email AngelList to get it turned off. So it was kind of an ordeal.
Yeah, I bet you have to show up in person and you actually have to track down Naval and grab him and wrestle him to the ground to be able to turn off AngelList. Yeah.
That's right. You have to personally fight each Rolling Fund lead to get your money back.
I guess as our usual outro here, normally we do a tease of Nikita's revealing his app. We actually just found out the joke, I guess, has been that we actually didn't think Nikita had an app. And so there was nothing to reveal. But it sounds like Nikita, you actually are building something now.
I am building an app.
Wow. So we don't even need to tease it. It's actually something real. Do we have a name yet?
Not yet. I don't know if it'll even launch, but toiling away.
Wow.
I can't wait.
Well, what I just heard is everyone send name suggestions in Nikita's inbox. Maybe just tweet at him and give him your best ideas.
What I heard is if you just start wiring money to Nikita, he has to take it. That's how I interpreted that sentence.